Now we'll be beginning on reincarnation tonight, and as Jez has mentioned, over the next 4 weeks, we'd love to see you. I won't be dealing with everything that could be dealt with about the things of the Christian faith. We'll look at reincarnation, some areas concerned with that, and over the next few weeks, we'll kind of build. Next week, we'll be looking at this. Reincarnation was the third most popular response when we asked people what happens after this life. We got about 15% of people said reincarnation. The second most popular is next week. The second most popular response was that there was nothing after this life. It just ends. The first most popular response is the week after that. We believe there's a heaven, not a hell. That was the first most popular response. I think it was 50% or something. I don't know if Adrian's around, but I think it was 50%. It was very large. And we'll be coming to that in 3 weeks' time. And then another very significant response was, I'd like there to be something. I just don't know if I can know what it is. And so we'll be looking in the final week at, is there evidence for what we claim about life after death? And it's an extraordinary amount of stuff to go through. And we just won't do that in the next couple of weeks, but we will be doing it on the fourth week. So I'd love to have you there with us as well tonight, for that night. How about I pray and we'll dig into reincarnation together. We do ask, please, Heavenly God, that you might do as you have promised, that you might open the door to those who do knock, who want to seek, who want to find. We pray that you might be found. And we ask, please, that you would cause that to happen tonight, that through these frail things like words, that you might reveal yourselves to people amongst us tonight. And we ask that by that you would bring life and bring the fullness of true life that's found in Jesus. And we ask it in his name. Amen. Well, reincarnation, let me engage with it by first sharing a story that Jesus told that will appear, well, it sounds like it already has appeared, initially totally unrelated to reincarnation. So watch the magic trip as it goes on through tonight. It's perhaps one of the most famous stories Jesus has told, and we're looking at it in an account of Jesus written by a man called Luke. So if you're unfamiliar with the Bible, there's a number of four accounts of the life of Jesus, things he said and did. Luke is one of them, and it's called Luke. We're very imaginative Christians. A bloke called Luke wrote it. We call it Luke. It's as simple as that. And this man, Luke, was a medical doctor in the first century. And he was someone who didn't know Jesus himself, but knew of those who were with him and spent a great deal of time researching the evidence for all that Jesus said and did. And so he went to all the eyewitnesses, well, not every single eyewitness, but many eyewitnesses, and pulled together all the information and gathered all of this and put it together in an orderly account, which is what we're looking at here. So you have, in Luke's account, effectively an eyewitness account of Jesus through the eyes, of course, of those who were witnesses. Now, our other accounts of the gospel, of the work of Jesus, the person of Jesus, were direct eyewitnesses. So Matthew and John were with Jesus, and they've written accounts as well. You can compare them. It's quite an extraordinary exercise to do and see the accuracy of it. But we're looking at Luke and what he recorded from the people that he spoke to, and the things that they talked about was the many stories that Jesus told. And in chapter 15 of Luke, we're given a story that Jesus told about the, what we call it, the parable of the lost son or the prodigal son. And it is very well known, even for people who don't know the Bible. Now, let me take you through it. Now, it'll come up on the screen again there if we can pull that off. And if you've got a Bible, it's Luke chapter 15. We're looking at verse 11. There you go. Jesus continued. He's in the middle of telling a number of stories. Now, this didn't happen. We don't know that it happened. It almost certainly didn't. It doesn't matter that it happened or not. Jesus is using a story to make some points. And he tells of a family, a man who had two sons. The younger son ups and leaves home. He demands his share of the inheritance. You can see that early on there. He says to the father, give me my share of the estate. Before his dad's dead, he wants his estate, which in itself is quite offensive, but effectively is saying, I don't want you in my life. I want the money that you've given me and I want to go. And so in this too, he's called the younger brother. Now, we're not told whether he was young himself. I'm a younger brother, and I know it's not necessarily obvious that I'm the young one, but the assumption is that he is a young man. Now, you can tell that he's a young man, I suggest, because of verse 13. You'll see it halfway through that chunk there. He went to a distant land and he spent everything there in wild living. Now, that tells you it's a young man, because if it was anyone who wasn't young, just an older man, he'd spend everything he had just in living. not wild. He'd spend it all on doctor's appointments, medical bills, medication, specialists, and so on. But you know this is a young man because he's squandered it on his wealth on wild living. Now, after he's been there for a short time, it all falls apart. But it seems that this young man leaves because he was chafing under his father. He wanted freedom. Or put that in inverted commas, he wanted what he saw freedom to be. And he wanted to get out from under his father into a place in a distant land where he could be free, he could do whatever he wanted to do, he could spend his money the way he wanted to spend it, without any sense of restraint or constraint from his father's expectations, without any sense that the father was looking disapprovingly on him. He just wanted to get away and do his own thing. And so he goes for it. He does spend as he chooses. He lives as he chooses. He's free, or so it seems. And after a time, his freedom then loses its gloss. He's lost everything now. He is living with the consequences of his choices. And Jesus says at this point, verse 21 in your Bible, he comes to his senses. I think it's the next screen along. He comes to his senses and realizes, if you can knock into the next screen, that'd be great. Yeah, when he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired men have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I'll set out and go back to my father." So he comes to his senses. He realizes the decisions he's made have been stupid. They've taken him into a place that he thought was going to be one thing, and it turns out to be much less. And he actually realizes that what he had back under his father, even as the lowliest in his father's household, would have been much better than his so-called freedom that he's experiencing at present. So he determines to swallow his pride, humble himself, and go home. Now, let me just make a quick point there. That is a very hard thing to do. It's very hard to have made a whole bunch of decisions, set out on a course of life, and come to the point where you realize, I have made a mistake. All that I thought and all that I did has been wrong. That is a very difficult thing, to swallow your pride like that. And the longer you go down that path, the harder it is to do. Very difficult indeed. Here is a man, though, who comes to that point. He humbles himself, and you can see the set of words that he uses there. It's an extraordinary thing. Verse 18, "I'll set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men.'" That's the nature of the humility that comes upon him. "I'll go back, but I'll go back with such a kind of broken awareness of my mistakes that, look, I don't even expect you to take me in. I'll be at the back. I'll just work there, but I want to work there better with you than I do here." That's the character of his humility. But when he comes back, when he does go home, he finds an extraordinary surprise. So verse 20, he gets up, goes back to his father, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him and ran to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him. Now the son goes through his speech, verse 21, "I've sinned against heaven, against you, I'm no longer worthy to be called." But verse 20, the father says to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe, put it on him, put a ring on his fingers, sandals on his feet, bring the fatted calf, kill it, let's have a feast and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead, he's alive again, he was lost and he's found." So they began to celebrate. Instead of the father doing what the son expected of him, which was, "You've treated me so badly, you've behaved so poorly, you've made such stupid decisions, out the back until you pay your debts, until you deal with all the things, then we might talk." The father actually says, "No, man, you're back. It's just thrilling to have you." The father was waiting for him to come back. Such was the love that the father had for this child. Now, it's a powerful story, and it's told actually for a very different reason. This won't surprise you. It's told for a very different reason than reincarnation. There is no verse in there that says, "See how this relates to reincarnation." It's got very hard to see that. It was told, and let me give you the context, that it was told by Jesus to have a dig at the religious leaders. Actually, that's why he gave it. You can see it in chapter 15, verse 1, if you've got a Bible, that he was actually, verse 1 and 2, he was addressing the Pharisees and the teachers, the religious people, the churchgoers, us. And he was saying to them, "You're really down on people who come into church with all that mess that they bring. Well, you need to realize what God is like. He's like the Father." And really, the story, the center of the story, ends up being the older brother who resents the Father's welcome. And Jesus gives this story to actually have a go at the religious people. That's the context. That's why he does it. But much of it does apply to this issue. How? Let me show you. Reincarnation especially in its Western guise, is driven by many of the same instincts that drove the prodigal son. And to show you what I mean, let me unpack reincarnation and explain reincarnation to you. There are two basic forms of reincarnation, and or at least in my estimation, and certainly for our purposes tonight. There are many different variations and so on, but there are two big streams that I want to talk to you about tonight. There is the religious stream of within which reincarnation sits, so Buddhism, Hinduism, Jainism, all kinds of all these different religions within which reincarnation finds a place. But then there's another stream that embraces the idea of reincarnation. It's the Western world. There's a version of reincarnation that runs within the Western society within which we live. And those two conceptions of reincarnation are somewhat different. And I'm going to suggest to you tonight it's helpful to appreciate the differences. Let me take you firstly through the religious structure that has reincarnation within it, Buddhism, Hinduism, and so on. The religious form within which reincarnation sits is compelled and driven by pessimism. There's the key word. It's driven and compelled by pessimism. People in the religious concepts of Buddhism and Hinduism and so on, they are compelled to reincarnation, to think about reincarnation because of the problem of suffering in life and the desire to get out of life, get off the wheel of life. It's a very pessimistic driver. Now, all of that concept of reincarnation in this world, there's four big concepts in this religious structure within which reincarnation finds itself. Let me take you through those four things. The first thing is, within Buddhism and Hinduism and so on, reincarnation sits within a worldview that believes that all things are part of a oneness. All of life and the cosmos is all united together. Everything is part of this one cosmic force, first thing. Second thing these religious worldviews hold is that human life is part of that oneness, but a dislocated part of that oneness. Dislocated in that humans, although of a piece with that one cosmic mind or existence or thing, are dislocated in the same way that a spark is dislocated from a fire. The fire is the oneness, the spark shoots out from it, is dislocated but of the same thing with, or in the same way the drop of water, when you drop a rock into the ocean, splashes up and is of the same stuff as the ocean, is part of the ocean in a sense, but is dislocated from the ocean. These worldviews and religions, all is one, but human life is part of that one in a dislocated form, like a spark from the fire. Third thing, it's separated or dislocated because of a thing called karma. Now, karma is a word that I'm sure you've all heard. Karma is the concept of the law of cause and effect. It's the law of cause and effect in this cosmos that we live within. There is this, built into the fabric of our existence, says these religious worldviews, is this thing called karma, where if you do good things, you will attract good things. If you do bad things, you will attract bad things. You will reap what you sow. If you do evil things, you will reap evil from it. If you do good things, you will reap good from it. It's a rule of law, karma says, of the universe, of this cosmos. Now, it's understood slightly differently in, say, Buddhism to Hinduism, and I might make some comments about that in a little while if time permits, but the problem is that humans have attracted to themselves bad karma. And because we've attracted to ourselves bad karma, we are kept separated and dislocated from the cosmic unity of existence. We have spun out from it and held outside of that ocean or that one fire. We exist apart from it. And we are now forced, says the Eastern religious mind, we are forced now to be bound to the wheel of life. The endless cycle of birth, suffering, death, rebirth, suffering, death, endlessly. There's number three. All of a unity, humanity is dislocated from that unity because of bad karma that's attracted to us. Fourth thing, the purpose of life is to therefore escape the wheel of life, suffering, death, life, suffering, death. The purpose of life is to escape that wheel and merge back into the ocean, the oneness, into the fire, the spark, back in again. Now, there it is. Do you see what I'm suggesting, the pessimism that's inherent in it? The pessimism is this. The aim of the Buddhist, the Hindu, this kind of religious construct in the Eastern world, which has reincarnation at its heart, the aim is to make this life the last life. To come to enlightenment that I can finally get off the wheel that binds me to birth, rebirth, suffering, death. I want to get out of it. Very pessimistic. Now, let me compare it to Western reincarnation. In the Western world, reincarnation is quite popular. As I said, 15% of the Central Coast that we spoke to at least responded and said they believed in reincarnation. But you do a survey across the country, and this has been done in recent times, 27% of Australians say that they believe in reincarnation. 27%, one in four. It's a very popular view. Not the main popular view, but a very popular view. Western people in our cultures and society are being drawn to reincarnation and to embrace this concept, but we are drawn to it because of optimism, a positive view, optimistic view. And there's three things that draw us to reincarnation, I'm going to suggest. Now, you might want to come to me later tonight and say, that's not what drew you. And please, I'd be helped to find out how the things... But generally speaking, this is what I'm suggesting. Three things. The first thing that draws Westerners to reincarnation is the eternality of life, which is just, I don't know if that's a helpful way, but it's just the eternal character of life. Life is eternal, eternality. So it's the idea that for Westerners, that there must be more than this life. Now, why is that the case for us? Well, we have all grown up in a society that has become more and more arid. What I mean by that is this. We've grown up in a culture that's been largely shaped and driven by the scientists. We're going to be touching more of this next week. But the scientific method deals with the things of stuff. Physics, chemistry, biology, geology, the things of matter. And the scientists deal with this kind of thing and have concluded and are driving through our society the concept that everything in the universe can be reduced just to matter. So that human life is nothing more, when you boil it all down, to physical stuff operating according to biological, chemical, physical rules. Your mind, your thinking, your affections and feelings are nothing more than the chemical reactions that are going on in your physical body. You are just physical robots that think you feel things, but you don't really. It's just the physical chemistry happening within you. Now, that's been the last 30 years, 40 years, perhaps longer, that's been a very dominant worldview amongst us. Many Westerners are living within that climate and culture saying, nah, that's not who I am. I look out from my head, which is what all of you are doing. We all look out this head thing, and we kind of look out there and we see things out there, but we have a sense that I'm someone doing the looking. Do you know, there's something in me that's not just my physical hand. There is this life that I have, this consciousness that feels impossible to reduce just to physicality and chemistry. And many people are convinced it can't be so. It's an inadequate way of thinking about humanity. There is a life, a consciousness that must be more than just my body. Now, listen to the words of a reincarnationist, a Westerner. He says this, quote, "This variety of life, where did it come from? It would be utterly meaningless if we appeared on this earth for one short earth life and then vanished and no good came of it. One life is utterly insufficient to produce the purpose of the cosmic mind. Who are we? With wonderful powers of feelings and ethical justice that so often goes against selfishness, there's divinity in this. A divine spark, a divine harmony and cosmic intelligence. End quote. Do you see what he's trying to say? Well, what are you saying? Is that there's got to be more to life than just this one life and the end with my physical end. There's got to be another existence that my life goes into. There's an eternal character to who I am. Now, I actually think that that's biblical that you feel that way. And if you are here tonight going, yes, that's how I feel too, I think it's been written in you, written within you by God. There's a book in the Old Testament called Ecclesiastes, chapter 3, verse 11. It says, God has written eternity into our hearts. He's actually written into the fabric of the shape of who we are, this sense that there's got to be more. And I think Westerners are feeling that. They're looking for answers to that. Now, there's another aspect too that compels Westerners. There's a first one. The second one that compels Westerners to the concept of reincarnation, it's the sense that it helps me explain suffering, or at least the reason why suffering is patchy. What I mean is this. When you look at life and as you see people around us, some people just keep going downhill all the time, don't they? Everything seems to go wrong with them. Now, I have a friend who married, first child dies, next child is autistic, the next child has serious physical problems that they need constant attention for. He then gets diagnosed with a serious cancer. They operate, they take him through chemo, he loses his sight, all the medication, and you're kind of going, I haven't had any of that. Why is he getting so much and I haven't? Well, people look, they wonder, they ask that question, and you haven't. If you haven't asked that question, you should be. Why is it that some people cop so much and others don't? Well, it compels people to actually reincarnation because reincarnation gives an answer. The answer is this. It says the reason some people cop so much and others don't is because of their past lives, their karma. That man who had all of that happen clearly had behaved badly, negatively, immorally, evilly, in an evil way, either in his earlier life or his past lives, and he was now paying for it with that negative karma that was attracting to him suffering. So there's one thing that compels people to reincarnation in the Western world. How do we explain all of this? It offers progress in the midst of that as well. It says, there's hope for you Westerners. If you are suffering, here's a real hope that if you behave a certain way and attract good karma, you'll actually start to undo that suffering so that in a future life you'll begin to progress upward and upward and become a much happier and much more fulfilling and much more wonderful experience of life. There's great optimism, a longing for more for the Westerner. The third thing I think that drives Westerners to reincarnation ties it in with the prodigal son. I think Westerners are driven to reincarnation because of the sense that we're eternal, there's got to be more, the sense that there's got to be an explanation for justice. None of that drives the person who's going to reincarnation towards God, though, and the biblical message. Why not? Well, I think it's because the drive is also a drive and a desire to be free from constraint. Reincarnation is attractive because we don't like the concept of external constraints over our life. We want to be free from a being that might be out there. We don't like the idea there's a being out there somewhere who is outside of us, who is over us, to whom we're accountable, who holds us accountable, who might one day judge us for the way we've lived. We don't like that concept. Reincarnation is attractive because it leaves me accountable to myself and myself alone. If my life is going badly, it's because I've done badly. If it's going well, it's because of me. I did it my way. I don't have to pay attention to anyone, any other body, any other person, God or not. And the idea of a personal God outside of us, over us, who might judge us, is constraining, it's limiting, it's squashing, it's crushing, it's oppressive. And so, we leave home. We leave home to find freedom in a distant land. where we can do what we do, choose what we choose, live the way we want to live. But here's the thing. The distant land that we have gone to as a society pursuing, say, reincarnation, isn't all it seems. And, I want to add tonight, the home that we left with a personal God, the God of the Bible, is very different than we have conceived it to be as well. Let me take you through that. The distant land. The distant land that we've gone to get away from all of this oppressive, constraining, someone's over us and we're accountable to. We've gone away from that to go to a distant land to have freedom finally. Reincarnation appears to answer the issues of eternality of the soul, fairness and dealing with suffering, and the need to be free. But when you dig into reincarnation, it's actually quite scary. And I'm going to do that with you tonight. It's very far from what Westerners hope it will be. And it promises something it doesn't deliver. Let me take you through each of these. The eternal character of life. We've drawn to it because we believe there's got to be more. There's an eternal spirit. One life is too little. The universe is too large to only experience it. We're drawn to it for all of these reasons. I get the drive for that. I think it's a biblical drive, but it's ill-considered. Let me take you through Eastern religions and then Western modern thinking. Eastern religions. Get this. The reincarnation concept within Eastern religions isn't the self that's reincarnated. It is merely a life force stripped of your self-conscious personality that is reborn. Now, in Hinduism does believe a human has a soul, but that soul that is reborn is born stripped of any personality. In Buddhism, it's more extreme. Buddha actually felt that Hinduism didn't go far enough, and the Buddha actually said that, no, there is no soul in a human. In fact, there's no individual life as a human at all. Your individuality is an illusion. It doesn't exist. You are one with this cosmic cosmos. It's not you. It's just a bundle of sensations. There is no you in you, says the Buddhist. Listen to a statement from their writings. Nirvana is, that is the end unification of all of life, the end point. Nirvana is, but not the man who seeks it. He doesn't actually exist. The path exists, but not the traveler on it. All is an illusion. And one of the tasks of the Buddhist is to pursue enlightenment where they come to appreciate the illusion they've been living under of self and the existence of self. Which means there's a great irony when modern Westerners, great individualists that we are, go on the trek to the East to find personal self-fulfillment, only to find, if we actually are honest and do a proper research, that if we go down the path of Eastern religions, we'll actually discover the journey of self-fulfillment is actually a discovery that there is no self to fulfill. You see, it'll all be stripped away. Now, I could give a little bit more theory, but listen to actually the account of someone who went through this journey. It comes from a book that's worth getting hold of. If you've not got it, it's called Death of a Guru. Death of a Guru. It's a very old book now. I think it's not out of print, I understand. So you could probably chase it up on Amazon for probably cost you 80 cents on Amazon. Delivery will cost you $50, but you'll be able to get the book for 80 cents. It really is a worthwhile book getting hold of. It's an account of a man who grew up in the highest caste within his religious setting, and his father was therefore a Brahmin, one of the highest caste, and he pursued enlightenment, and for 8 years sat in their house in the lotus position meditating. They had to feed him, they had to clean him, all of that, while he was caught up in seeking enlightenment and union again with the cosmic reality. He didn't speak once to his children or his wife and then died. Now, this man grew up with that father, knowing that he should be honoured that he had such a father, but all he lived with was the complete destruction of personal relationship and the denial of that relationship, and then lost his mother to a monastery who also gave herself to this path as well. And much of that caused him to begin to question and pursue a little bit more deeply the things of life, which led him eventually to Christian faith. Death of a guru. Now there's the religious package. Let me give you the modern Western one. Modern Western package hasn't thought all of that through as much, typically. But think with me about this for a moment. We just want many lives because our current life, it just feels too short to only have one life. We want to have lots of experiences of lives in the future. But think with me about this. Your current life, if you're a believer in reincarnation, your current life is at the end of many lives, if your conviction's true. And you can't remember any of them. Can't remember any of them. Because the fact is, if your view is the way you conceive it, when you die, it'll be a life force or merely karma that is reincarnated. It won't be you. You won't remember it. You won't have experienced it. It'll be lost to you. Now, there are some who believe that you can recover memories from past lives, but that is fraught as you study the evidence for it all. It is very slight, and it is rarely experienced anyway. And if it is experienced at all in the literature, it's very, very lame. It's not a very rich experience, your reincarnation pursuit, which leaves many in this world of reincarnation eventually in this distant land very disillusioned. I heard tell of a lady just this last week who is kind of into reincarnation and rebirth and so on, and found that was very appealing to her and enriching and brought much comfort and hope until her husband died. And with the death of a husband, initially there was this sense of joy and gladness that his life will continue on, until she began to realize that if his life continued on, she would never know him. Because it wouldn't be her husband, it would be the life force and not the person or personality. Which then drives you to the conviction clearly that I've lost him and I'll never know him again. Gone. No hope. It's important to get this, friends, because I just saw someone sent me a link to a Discovery Channel portrayal of a funeral in India on the Ganges River. And the Western commentator was speaking about this funeral with much kind of gladness and kind of appreciation. They didn't wear black, he said, they wear white, such is their enthusiasm and hope and confidence in the future. That this 20-year-old son that's died, the father is actually able to have confidence that he will be reborn again. Now, Western and commentators looking at that need to actually think a little deeper, because that 20-year-old son will never be met again by the father, because he won't exist as a 20-year-old son ever again. Gone. Gone. Now, none of this is saying that reincarnation is false. I haven't said that. I'm simply suggesting to you that the distant land that many things have compelled us to, that we've pursued for the sake of getting freedom and explanations of suffering and the satisfaction of a fuller, richer, eternal life, isn't delivered. Let me pick up the fairness one and show what it doesn't deliver as well. It does seem to offer an explanation, but when you think deeper or live longer in the Eastern religious far country, distant land, it becomes a very different conception of justice than the one we've ever imagined. Suffering, for the reincarnationist, is explained by the necessary rule of cause and effect. That is to say, all suffering and pain is a consequence of payback by this impersonal law called karma. That is, if I'm suffering now, it will be because of some personal evil, either early in my life or in a previous life, that has attracted this suffering. Got the concept? Let me apply it with you for a moment. You think, therefore, about the 13-year-old girl who is raped and abused by leaders that she should trust, destroys a life She's not able to marry, hold down a relationship. She's completely devastated. She becomes psychotic, crushing. What does the reincarnationist have to say? Well, what they are driven to say is that she has only herself to blame because it's her karma. Clearly, she has either committed evil or negativity in her previous part of her life or in a past life somewhere that's attracted to her this great suffering that she's now going through. Comfort for the 13-year-old? Now, that may well sound shocking, and you might well wonder, could that really be what they think? Let me give you the words of a reincarnationist, a Hindu. You may never have heard of this man, but there's a man called Glenn Hoddle. He was the soccer manager for the English soccer team. So quite a well-regarded man in the English world. I can't believe it with a soccer thing, but anyway, he was a Hindu, and he expressed his Hindu beliefs in an interview with the London Times newspaper. This is just history. And he said this, listen to this. "You and I have been physically given two hands and two legs and half-decent brains. Some people have not been born like that for a reason. The karma is working from another lifetime. I have nothing to hide about that. It's not only people with disabilities. What you sow, you reap." Quote. Now, I'm not sure about your reaction tonight, but England was outraged when they heard him say that. It went all the way up to the Prime Minister, and he was sacked. He lost his job over it. And the reason they were outraged, I hope you see the reason why they were outraged, was because of this. They saw the implications of what he was saying. The implications of what he was saying was this: the disabled were clearly morally inferior. The reason a person was disabled in this view of life, which is not mine, but in this view of life, the reason a person is disabled is because they were morally inferior. They had committed evil in a previous life or in the earlier part of their life. It was therefore their own fault that they were born the way they were born. And the healthy and wealthy people, they deserved it because of the way they had behaved in a previous life. Now, that is an extraordinary thing. Actually, the little finish to that story, someone drew my attention this morning to the fact there's a book with all of this outlined in it, and Glenn Hoddle actually went to the Dalai Lama and asked whether he had said the wrong thing, whether he was actually presenting properly what their convictions were. And the Dalai Lama apparently, chase this up, said, no, that's correct. We just don't talk about that in Western culture because it's found to be so offensive. You see, all of this fails to achieve and deliver what many people imagine it might. Let me push it a little bit further and think with me about Hitler for a moment. Hitler kills 6 million Jews, or officiates over an organization that kills 6 million Jews. Horrendous. The problem for Hitler is, well, the problem for us with Hitler is that he dies by his own hand before he's brought to justice. He's never been brought to justice. Well, the reincarnationist says that's not a problem because his evil will be balanced out in his future lives. But it won't be as Hitler. Some small child will be born in Erina named Graham Johnson. And I'm sorry if that's you here tonight. but Graham Johnson is born in Erina. And he finds himself constantly suffering. He contracts diseases regularly. He's abused by those who are over him. He's bullied at school. He keeps having accidents. He's constantly distressed and hurt. And finding himself going, why? Why is this all happening to me? Well, a reincarnationist says, because you were born with Hitler's karma. And Graham says, but I didn't do it. I didn't kill 6 million Jews. It's your karma that's been born with your life. And so as Graham suffers for Hitler. You know, the fact is life in us compels the great majority of us to see that there's got to be more than just this life. It compels us to see that there's got to be justice and righteousness done that we're not seeing in this life. And for those that run with these things into the law of karma, cause and effect, reincarnation, the distant land looks so freeing, and we're pursuing freedom as well. But it ends up, when you live in that distant land, destroying everything that we hold dear. It destroys personality, it destroys personal relationships, it destroys actually true personal justice. And I'm suggesting that we're compelled down this path because of our sense that to be under a personal God would be oppressive. The truth is very different. Now, reincarnation, karma, drive two other things, and let me pull it together. It creates a culture that is fatalistic and pessimistic. It creates a culture that is fatalistic and pessimistic. Fatalistic in that suffering, therefore, is necessary. If karma is the rule that shapes all of our existence, then suffering is necessary. Fighting against suffering is like fighting against the balancing of the cosmos. You cannot win. And the Eastern religious person who embraces most consistently this thinking ends up being a very quiet, still kind of person. And Westerners look on and are attracted to their contentment and in their frenetic pace want some of that. Clearly their philosophy has led them to it. But what they've been led to is not contentment, it's a different thing, it's fatalism. It's the sense that whatever happens to me in my life, I absorb the pain, I suffer with it, and the grief that comes I accept with real fatalistic sense that I can't do anything about it. It's the only way to balance and find a better life. It's very fatalistic and very pessimistic. What hope is there that this life force in me might climb the ladder of progress and not go down further? Well, it is only a hope to be found in me and my efforts and my abilities and my absorbing sufficient suffering that I might attract a balance that will mean this life force goes up. It's all about me and what I do. It's all dependent on me. And there is nothing to interrupt this unrelenting demand on me achieving a better future for myself. And at this point, the Christian faith shines. At this very point, Jesus enters the picture. And Jesus, he says, comes into the world, Luke chapter 19, verse 10, to seek and save the lost. Jesus comes to break the cycle of spiraling down in our brokenness and karma negatively. And he comes to bring mercy and step us out of it where there was only merit before. He comes to rescue us by a gracious gift of forgiveness, sent by the God, the Father, who loves us so much, who wants life for us, with him, forever, rescued and redeemed. And he achieves that by the extraordinary thing of his Son coming into our world to offer his life as a ransom for many. That is, Jesus comes into the world to take upon himself all our negative karma, to attract to himself everything that we've ever done that's evil, that's sinful, that's selfish, that's offensive to God. Jesus takes all of that upon ourselves instead of leaving it with us to have to suffer for. He suffers it in our place that we can have his free gift of his righteousness and his positive karma that will take us into relationship with the Father forever. It's an extraordinary story that the New Testament delivers to us about this historical character, the person of Jesus, that we'll come to the evidences of in coming weeks. You see, the prodigal son may be a story. It didn't really happen. But in it, Jesus was sharing how he sees not just that this person was, but how all humanity has been. We have walked away from God. We've walked away from home. And we've treated God as if we don't want him in our life. We've pushed him off after an illusion of freedom in a distant land where there's no constraint. And we've decided that the way to gain all of that was to get rid of this one over us and to now live my life as I choose. But in fleeing that constraint, we've actually run away from true freedom. We've run away from a God who is very different from what we've told ourselves. The God who is there is the God who is like the Father in that story Jesus tells. He's the one who searches for us. He's the one who actually wants relationship with you. He wants to break through your ignorance and, at many levels, our self-deceit and bring us back home, where we'll find the life that we long for and were made for. You know, it is necessary in all of this, though, for you to come to your senses. You remember how we told of this young man who, in the distant land, realized that what he had longed for he wasn't finding. He came to his senses, he humbled himself, swallowed his pride, and determined to go back to the Father and say, "I'm sorry." And the Father, astonishingly, welcomed him home. Well, that's necessary tonight as well, to come to our senses and to acknowledge that the distant land that we ran to, away from home, away from God, is not all it was cracked up to be, and we've made a mistake. We've hurt our God in the process. We've offended him. Coming to our senses means acknowledging that, humbling yourself, and determining to come back. To come back to this God who astonishingly is the one who welcomes us. He doesn't put us out the back and say, "You've got to work off your debts." He says, "Come back." He rejoices in anyone's return, and he doesn't crush you. Yes, there's constraint. There's constraint in living under God, but it's not the constraint of an oppressive tyrant. It's the constraint of loving relationship. It's the constraint of living in a loving relationship with God, who is God and I'm not, who calls on me to live in a way that will actually bring the best. That's the constraint he calls us to. Life in the end that's to the full. There's extraordinary things that we want to discover together over the next weeks, but let me finish by using the words of a surprising advocate for all of this. A man you might have heard of, a man called Bono. You heard of U2? It's old now, but listen to the words of Bono. This was in an interview. You can find, chase it up on the internet. It's all there. He said this: "It is a mind-blowing concept that the God who created the universe might be looking for company, a real relationship with people." It is a mind-blowing concept. "But the thing that keeps me on my knees is the difference between grace and karma. You see, at the centre of all religions is the idea of karma. You know, what you put out comes back to you, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. It's clear to me that karma is at the very heart of the universe. I'm absolutely sure of it." I think he's right. "And yet along comes this idea called grace to upend all of that, as you reap, so you sow stuff. Grace defies reason and logic. Love interrupts, if you like, the consequences of your actions, which in my case is very good news indeed, because I've done a lot of stupid stuff. I'd be in big trouble if karma was going to finally be my judge. I'd be in deep..." He swears at that point, and I think he just shows his need for grace. "But I'd be in trouble if karma were going to finally be my judge. I'd be in deep... It doesn't excuse my mistakes, but I'm holding out for grace. I'm holding out that Jesus took my sins to the cross, because I know who I am, and I hope I don't have to depend on my own religiosity." You don't. "The point of the death of Christ is that Christ took on the sins of the world so that what we put out does not come back to us, and that our sinful nature does not reap the obvious death. That's the point. It should keep us humbled. It's not our good works that get us through the gates of heaven." How astonishing is that? I mean, astonishing that Bono said it, but what he says is remarkable. It's a remarkable message that the Bible has for us. The true God actually doesn't treat us as we deserve. He comes and gives you mercy and grace and forgiveness, and comes and says, "Welcome back." Don't live with the horror and fear of facing the consequences of your own negative karma. Come out from under that by the merits of Jesus Christ, a man who truly lived, died, and rose again so that you could be forgiven and restored again in relationship at home with the God who is the God of that story, one who is full of love. Come to your senses and come back. You need to come to your senses to come back. It doesn't happen automatically. You need to make a decision. How about I pray to that end? Let's do that. Our great God, we thank you for the extraordinary account of who you actually are, that you are so different to the ones we have told ourselves that you are, to the deceit that we've often lived with. We thank you for the revelation we find of you in the Bible, the true God, the God full of grace and mercy and forgiveness and kindness and generosity, the God who actually sends his own Son to absorb in himself our evil, our karma, that he might suffer where we ought to have suffered, so that we can actually have given to us as a gift his righteousness, that we can now be accounted with you just and accepted, welcomed back home. I'd pray for us tonight that please you might work amongst us and cause some amongst us who are puzzling about these things, who have been thinking about these things for a while, that please you might bring them, us, to our senses, that we might humble ourselves and come home. And we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.